This is BBC Radio 4, and now Unsung Heroes. On September the 11th, when the Twin Towers were attacked, communication networks were severely affected. Amateur radio enthusiasts knew instantly that they would be called upon to provide alternative means of communication for the agencies involved in the search and rescue operation. The BBC's Stephen Evans, who witnessed the attacks, meets the ham radio operators who stepped forward to provide this vital means of support at Ground Zero.
Manhattan urgent.
Marine 6.
Tower 2 has had a major explosion and what appears to be a complete collapse surrounding the entire area.
Terrorists have attacked the World Trade Center. I said, no, you've got to be kidding. And all I had to do was go outside of my house down the hill a little bit and I could actually see the towers smoking. So I knew for sure that we had been attacked.
Who's involved in the secondary explosion at Tower 1K? I've got 5 patients. They need to be treated and transported. Okay, I have them in my command car. You have to direct me to the nearest treatment center.
When I came back into the house, I immediately turned my radio on because I knew there would be an emergency net running. It was time to help.
Please state your technical.
This is Compassion. Control, Compassion. If you recall, I have traffic for HQ. Compassion, go. This is KETY1.
For Americans, and particularly New Yorkers, the world changed at precisely 8:46 on the bright blue morning of September the 11th, 2001. It was at that moment that American Airlines Flight 11 crashed into Tower 1, the North Tower, of the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. Herman Belderock, a ham radio operator, was in the building on the 71st floor, barely 20 floors below the impact.
I heard this hiss that gradually started from, you couldn't hear it, till this very loud hiss, and then a huge explosion, bam. I saw some debris fall past the windows. Some people were coming back from getting breakfast down in 43, continued to walk to their cubes as if nothing ever happened.
Despite the closeness, Herman and his colleagues had no way of knowing that a large civilian plane, a Boeing 767, had just slammed into the building. Burning aviation fuel created an inferno above, an inferno that destroyed communications equipment. Cables melted, cell phones went dead, and power was cut off. Fellow radio hams working in the area, some of whom witnessed the attacks, knew straight away that their own communication skills would be needed. The towers, after all, bristled with aerials and what are called repeaters that boosted radio signals that the emergency services relied on.
We were watching the news reports, and we actually saw the second tower get hit. And I told everyone, I said, forget it, your phones are not going to work anymore. I knew as a ham radio operator that the antennas for communication were all located on the top of those buildings.
I walked to the edge of my cube. I didn't really want to stay. I didn't really want to go. When I got to the door that leads to the outer hallway, when my hand touched the door, that's when I completely changed to, I'm getting out of here. I flew, absolutely flew down the stairs.
I'm on the Staten Island ferry heading out from the tip of Manhattan. The tip of Manhattan, of course, minus that distinctive skyline, those two towers that stuck up like two teeth on the tip of the island. I'm heading towards Staten Island, past the Statue of Liberty, to meet Charles Hargrove, who is the coordinator for the civil emergency part of the Ham Radio Operators Organization for the whole of New York City, all the 5 boroughs.
May I have your attention, please? The ferry will be docking shortly. Thank you for riding the Staten Island ferry.
That is a PL deck on the controller.
The repeater systems that we use are put in high enough locations that we can take a low power radio like this and it will receive them on one frequency and rebroadcast them out on higher power, higher elevation. It goes further.
That is a PL deck on the controller.
Now, the great virtue of ham radios is that they're low-tech. They rely on low-power signals that then get boosted and passed on by the repeaters across New York. And because the radios are portable, they are versatile in emergencies. As soon as Charles learned of the attacks, he took his radio out of his briefcase.
My office was at the 17th floor, so I had a high enough vantage point that even a small walkie-talkie that only ran 1 watt or 5 watts can actually hit the repeaters very well.
What operation was then got up and running by ham radio operators?
I called on there to see if anybody else had tuned in, because I'd been training the people that if something was to happen, tune to this frequency. Called on the air. Some of the guys were already on there. I asked one of them to start up a net, take check-ins, find out where the people are. Are they available? When are they available? At the same time, I turned on another radio that I carry with me, which was one of the trunking radios from OEM, Emergency Management. That radio was a coordination between the amateur operators and other agencies to OEM. So I had two radios going at once. So while we were waiting to find out from OEM what they wanted us to do, we were running our operation, getting things ready. And in that process, the tower started falling.
The building starts to shake. A very fast vibration shake. I looked at the floor and I said, "This is where I will die. Death, judgment, heaven, hell, and purgatory. All right, let's see what happens." And the shaking continued, and the shaking stopped.
As Herman was working his way down Tower 1, Tower 2 fell, and buildings all around lost their communication links.
Frank Catalinas, November 2, Uniform Mike Charlie.
Frank Catalanus, a lawyer and keen ham radio operator, worked right opposite the World Trade Center. And when his office's phone links were cut, he and his colleagues were left in the dark, as it were, about what exactly was unfolding around them. So Frank turned on his scanner.
And 6 trucks and 3 battalions are responding for various staging points. Are you ready to write the identities?
Yeah, go ahead, man.
All right, you're going to get engine 258, 259. 325-262-312-261-261.
In the United States, ham radio operators are legally allowed to eavesdrop on the emergency services. It's perhaps a measure of how their importance is recognized by the authorities. Listening to these police and fire department frequencies, Frank and his colleagues realized the seriousness of the situation.
Marine 6 to Manhattan, urgent.
Marine 6.
Tower 2 has had a major explosion and what appears to be a complete collapse surrounding the entire area.
All the busyness between the policemen and the firemen and the emergency medical workers, the silence that came over the frequency when the buildings fell, we knew it was very serious.
Banana field come. 26 standby, banana field come. Banana field come.
Okay, this guy's call is Kilo Kilo 4 India Papa. I'm not too good at Morse code.
As the hams swung into action in New York City itself, Tom Karuba was on standby an hour out of town, to the east of New York, in Babylon, Nassau County.
Finally, we heard the New York City people come up and try to establish the net, or begin to establish the net.
From his ham shack in Babylon, Tom was to become the coordinator of more than 200 ham operators who were traveling by now from every corner of the whole state of New York and even the wider United States to help the Red Cross.
I checked in as a section emergency coordinator, let them know that we can hear them, let them know that we are on standby, that we are, as they speak, gathering people to help them in their communications or help them in any way that we can.
In July 2004, the 9/11 Commission published its findings on preparedness and the response to the terrorist attacks. It concluded that fire and police officers had trouble communicating because the effectiveness of their radios was severely impaired. However, some communications were still getting through to emergency service workers in Tower 1, where Herman was still trying to escape.
Somebody got a radio call in and said it was asking for head counts. One of the firefighters asked one of the police officers that was there to get a head count. He counts about up to 20 and then guesstimates the rest and says about 40. I was the third person in line, not the 40th person in line. So they said, everybody put your left hand on the left shoulder in front of the person in front of you and march that way. So they shined a flashlight into the hallway, and it seemed like just a beam that came straight out from that flashlight. So there was dust in the air, I guess. We marched down the stairwell. Water had started flowing down the stairs by the time we got to like the fifth or fourth floor. And from there on, it seemed like there was almost nobody in front of us because we were actually able to walk as fast as you desired down the stairs.
Well, that morning I was working at home, and all I had to do was go outside of my house down the hill a little bit, and I could actually see the towers smoking.
Mike Bartman from Staten Island is a member of New York's Amateur Radio Emergency Service. After the Office of Emergency Management gave HAM volunteers the task of providing communication networks for the Red Cross, Mike was allocated his first assignment.
Any survivors injured from the attack would be taken by ferry to Staten Island, and they would have a triage center set up there. I was working with the doctor in charge there to help him communicate with the rest of the city. Of course, after a while, we realized that there weren't going to be any injured coming out of there, any living injured.
I'm on the Brooklyn side of the East River, looking out at Lower Manhattan, that famous skyline. Beside me is the Brooklyn Bridge, then the Manhattan Bridge. Now, on that day, September the 11th, 2001, Brett Weinkoop is with me now, cycled in that direction onto Manhattan as other people were coming in this direction. What did you do?
I loaded up my communications gear, food, water. So I was riding through this massive cloud of smoke and dust and ash from the World Trade Center. If you looked towards Lower Manhattan, it looked like an atom bomb had gone off. I got a call on the radio asking me to go to Red Cross headquarters. The first thing was I was assigned to a shelter at Junior High School 22 to provide communications for the shelter. There was a lot of housing that people couldn't use in Lower Manhattan. Many of these people, because of the debris and the thick smoke, were displaced and had nowhere to go.
Control, Compassion, if you recall, I have traffic for HQ.
Compassion, go. This is KET1.
What I've got for you is that they have relief for the people at midnight. The people will be burnt out by then.
How important do you think the role of amateur radio operators was on that day and the succeeding days?
Well, I think it was very important. The city had put all its eggs in one basket for communications. They had all their repeater systems for relaying police, fire, and ambulance traffic pretty much on the World Trade Center. When the World Trade Center was lost, those systems went off the air.
I get a really good feeling inside when I think about how I was able to help and the fact that I had means to help. And I was able to help because I was prepared.
Mike Bartman, a volunteer ham, had taken part in many emergency drills with Charles Hargrove and was picked out for a special assignment.
Charlie was looking for people to accompany Red Cross teams down to Ground Zero. The Red Cross was there to see if people needed a place to live, did they need food, clothing. And each of these teams consisted of a mental health person, a nursing professional, regular Red Cross volunteers, and a radio operator. It was considered essential because there was no other reliable communication, and these teams were going in there all by themselves.
Met Control, this is W2IK at IS89.
What's your location?
Pretty close to Ground Zero. It's the high asbestos area that I've been living in for the past 30 hours.
My name is Robert Robinson, and my call is KB2PSM, that's Kilo Bravo 2, Papa Sierra Mike. I've been licensed for 11 years.
My name is Phyllis. My call sign is KC2DKD, Kilo Charlie 2, Delta, Kilo Delta.
Robert and Phyllis Robinson from Long Island, New York, are one of two husband and wife ham teams who volunteered after September the 11th. They were asked to report to Red Cross headquarters.
We gathered all our equipment, you know, we had our jump kits ready, and we went into a Red Cross van, I think it was late afternoon, almost early evening, and headed over into Manhattan, and it was like we were in a war zone. And when I passed through those streets and all those workers, and they all kind of scratched their heads and looked at us, like, what were we doing down there? Because we don't look like police officers or firemen or ambulance workers. When we told them that, you know, we were down there to support them and help them with communications and try to get their message out, we felt like comrades in arms in a way.
They set us up in what was IS 89 Intermediate School. It was about a block away from the World Trade Center.
Even where we were operating, all the windows were covered in a cement ash that made it very difficult to even get our antennas out. We couldn't even open some of the windows. They were sealed with all of this debris.
We basically served as the backup to the communication that the FBI and the other agencies had established downstairs, that they needed to get any information through to Red Cross. They would send a runner up to us, and we would get the message out.
I got down. I caught up to the people in front of me on the ground floor. Finally saw the turnstiles. One was dumped over. One was missing its three-pronged bars that you push. And I finally realized, oh, this is the lobby of Tower 1. It just looked like no one had been in the building in 1,000 years. Just there was dust all over the walls, a light coating of dust, marble hanging onto the walls by a thread. A firefighter at the turnstiles by the front door said, go to him, which is another firefighter at the northern westernmost window, and he directed us out the window. The window was completely out, so you wouldn't hurt yourself. It was just a big square. I got out of the building. After I get out from underneath the crosswalk, I said, okay, I gotta take a look at this. And I looked up and I just saw a river of fire, a waterfall of fire, coming out of the west side of my building and going up. Tower 1 came down, and it was starting to make a rolling thunder type sound.
So if you'd had your radio there that day and been delayed communicating, you wouldn't be here to tell the tale now.
If I had that radio that day, I don't know. Maybe it was good that I didn't have it that day.
Well, I'm driving now down Prospect Avenue in the town of Nutley, which is about, I don't know, 40 minutes outside New York City. It's classic American suburbia, the stars and stripes flying from shops, from porches in this area. And I'm going to see Eileen Siri, whose husband Robert died on that day, September the 11th, 2001. He was a radio ham operator who was also a policeman who worked for the Port Authority in Lower Manhattan.
We are deeply saddened by the loss you suffered in the tragic event September 11th. Our world and all of our lives have changed forever. May God bless you and your family, and may God bless America. George Bush and Laura Bush. He was on the 27th floor of Tower 1, and I know that from the Port Authority radio transmissions that they let me listen to. But I also got a phone call from him that morning from the police radio to my desk at work here in New Jersey, and he said he was over there and that he loved me and the girls, and I said, it looks really bad, that you need to just really get out of there. He told me he was going to shoot out some windows, that people were coming out in the wrong direction, meaning it was smoky and there was fires and they didn't see it. They were just running toward the front door, and that was the unsafest way to go. So his team, they shot out windows so the people could go out an alternate route. And he promised me that was all he was doing, and he was going to call me as soon as he could, and he wasn't going to start to head up or anything. But then 5 months later, piecing the pieces together, he did head up, and he got up to the 27th floor.
He and I used to talk every day, 2-3 times a day. We enjoyed it a lot. He and I would just chit-chat about anything and everything that was going on.
Scott Buell was Robert's best friend and ham buddy. They shared an enthusiasm and even a love for the pastime.
It's been disappointing without his voice on the radio and him coordinating. But we do work on it and we do communicate. It's got a great group of guys out there.
How much did it all mean to him?
He loved it. He loved talking to people all over the world. He was a talker. So when I came home at night, I used to walk through the door, and it was so loud. There was a scanner in the living room. There was a radio in the dining room. In the kitchen, something else was going on. I would turn them all off, head up the stairs to change into my sweats or something, and then by the time I came back down the stairs, all the radios were back on again, and then I just had given up. Every night. Every single night. Scott, you're ruining it.
It's true.
It was true. Every single night.
I was one of the first paramedic units from New Jersey to arrive at the towers. We arrived right after the second tower collapsed. And we made it our mission to try and check around everywhere we could to find them. We looked, and there was just nothing we could do. It was very frustrating for everyone. And it was like, welcome to hell. You know, they still missed. And
call sign is on his tombstone. When I was ordering my husband's tombstone, it was a month before his body was discovered, and I had placed his call signs, KA2OTD, on his tombstone, and it's there to this day. So when you visit his grave in North Arlington, it has his call signs, so everyone knows he's a ham radio operator.
I've seen some things in there. I didn't realize that things that are coming out of the building were people. To me, I'll never forget it.
Although Joseph Carpentieri suffered the trauma of actually witnessing the attacks, when he got home, he keyed into his ham radio and was assigned to work at a Red Cross compassion center.
What happened was people were coming in every day, and the idea of the compassion, they were coming in with the family members and everything, were coming in to find out if anybody located their loved ones. And So, you know, they brought whatever they had, hairs, whatever it was, for DNA testing. And I stayed there for 3 days doing that.
You saw some pretty terrible things on that day, but you were also helping.
Mm.
Does the helping help the process in your own mind?
Yes,
help you adjust to it?
Yes. I helped as many, you know, you see people running from, they were all covered with, they looked white when they were coming because they had the building, one building, the first building fell. So we try to help them. And by assisting what you could do, whatever I can do, getting a cold rag or doing something, you felt like yourself. I think it put some at ease to me that I was doing something.
Well, I know I changed as a person when Tower 2 came down and I was in Tower 1 still.
One of the things that I notice is that I didn't think it had any effect, but actually it has a lot of effects, sort of deep within your psyche in lots of strange ways. Maybe to do with becoming quieter, I think, probably. And I'm wondering what you think the changes are in you.
Well, it has taken a long time for all of it to sink in. I notice I never used to be scared of loud noises before, but now I am, especially ones that are overhead.
My name is Jeff Schneller. I'm the amateur radio liaison officer for Saturn, which is the Salvation Army Team Emergency Radio Network.
Along with the Red Cross, the Salvation Army was also crucial in the operation at Ground Zero. It ran canteens to feed the rescue workers, a relentless, utterly demanding task. Again, amateur radio operators were called upon to provide essential communications. Jeff Schneller was in charge of the operation.
It's like a joke now with some of the hams in the area that monitored our traffic. We had orders come through like pallet loads of beef, pallet loads of soda, pallet loads of milk. It was just a massive, massive operation.
And so where did the radio operators fit into that operation?
They were the only link between those field sites and headquarters, which is what was sending all of the supplies down there.
It's pretty impressive to get an operation that sophisticated up and running using part-timers and amateurs. They don't like the word, you don't like the word, but that's what these people are.
Mm-hmm. A fair percentage of the amateur radio operators practice when they can, they drill when they can, to be prepared for this type of thing. When all else fails, amateur radio works. Out in California, where they have earthquakes a lot, it's right in all of the disaster plans. Amateur radio has to be there.
My name is Carlos Veron. My call sign is K2LCV.
Carlos Veron worked closely with Jeff Schneller.
There was no PD, police department. There was no fire department. There was people helping people. I drove my truck in and out, as many of the other volunteers driving in and out. We have to be washed. Our trucks have to be cleaned and disinfected and washed down. But there was one thing that got emotional was on the West Side Highway. There was a lot of people, and there was, I don't remember the name, if whether there was a Citizens Island or the but these people stayed out there a long time for us.
And they were cheering.
And they were cheering, and they had signs, and they were there all the time, and they were there for us. We were there for them.
OEM to net control.
Net, stand by 1 second. Net, this is KB6LEE at Red Cross headquarters. I'm requested to do a shelter count now. May I take the
net? Amateur radio, hero, no. I don't think any amateur radio person that was involved would categorize himself as a hero. The heroes are the guys that went up and stayed in those buildings, getting people out, knowing that they may not get out. We came away with the satisfaction that we were able to support the heroes, the real heroes, without a doubt. There's no question or not.
Red Cross, this is AV2MH.
MH, go ahead.
Net control, KC-289, New York City Races.
I'm going to roll home. I got to get some rest.
Yep, you do that, sir.
Now, ham radio operators have a bit of a reputation. Enthusiasts, certainly, but nerds, anoraks, geeks, too. But in the aftermath of that bright, dark morning, they proved themselves. They were the amateurs who stepped forward quietly to provide a professional, life-saving public service. In doing so, they saw and heard much suffering, suffering that remains in many of their minds. For me, anyway, these public-spirited people are some of the unsung heroes of a day that produced the worst, but also the best, that humanity can offer.
I feel proud. I feel proud now, and I feel proud what I did. Nobody has to tap me on the shoulder. I feel like I did something for 9/11. I wish I could have done more, but that's... I mean, if I could have had a shovel, I would have went there, too. But, I mean, it wouldn't allow me to. But I think we did what we had to do. And the thing is, I think it'll remain in our heart. All the time.
Unsung Heroes was presented by Stephen Evans and produced by Kate Bissell. It was an all-out production for BBC Radio 4.